Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 382nd episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I am a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and a professor at the University of Alberta, and we are continuing on with Gary, who spent last podcast regaling us with his enthusiasm to help solve the dilemma of poverty and challenges of social determinants of health and improving healthcare. Welcome, Gary.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Yeah, and just let the audience again know who you are.
Sure. So I'm Gary Block. I'm a family physician with St. Michael's Hospital in downtown Toronto, as well as Inner City Health Associates, which is a group that works with people experiencing homelessness in downtown Toronto. And I'm here because my passion really centers on thinking about what we can do as frontline providers about the social issues that challenge our patients' health.
Yeah. So in the previous podcast, we identified how you can figure out if there are issues like poverty that are impacting health. And now for the next 30 minutes, Gary, you're going to tell us how to solve the whole problem.
Easy. No problem.
Yes.
So should we, you know, we sort of ended the last podcast talking about the clinical tool on poverty and as an entryway for dealing with social issues like poverty on the front lines in a typical kind of family practice type setting, appointments, 5, 10, 15 minute appointments. And I guess I wanted to take that a step or two further because, you know, for me, again, that really is just a starting point. It's a really important starting point because I think that is kind of the entryway into our entire medical system. But I actually think there are bigger ways that we can start thinking about this as frontline health providers. And I would start actually by looking at what we can do with our health teams. And I work with what's called a family health team with St. Michael's Hospital. It's kind of a big multidisciplinary primary care health team. And luckily for me, it's one that is very interested in thinking about how do we address the social determinants of our patients' health. And over the last, 7 years or so, we've put in place kind of a series of interventions, team-based interventions that directly tackle those social determinants of health. So maybe I can just describe some of those for you, just give you a sense of what we have done. And you know, I in no way expect every health team out there to be able to jump in and start doing this stuff, but I do think that with a bit of creative thinking and a bit of creative approaches to funders, this is possible in many different settings. So that's kind of the framework that I'm hoping people will listen to this with.
Yeah, no, that sounds perfect. So, just go crazy.
Sure. Okay. So we actually had this kind of outpouring of program development really around the end of 2013. And the first one, and again, maybe the one that's garnered the most attention, was the development of something called an Income Security Health Promotion Program. And what this is that we actually have two full-time specialists on our team who only deal with our patients' income security. And they do this in a number of ways. They do this mostly through intensive one-on-one assessments with patients around their financial situation, looking at ways to increase their income, to reduce their expenses, to help them manage their finances, to decrease the pressure of living at low income on them and on their health. And I can tell you this program has been hugely successful. I mean, we are actually running, as we speak, a randomized controlled trial of this program, which hopefully will give some more definitive data. But even just looking at preliminary data on this, we have found that the average increase in income for our low-income patients coming through this program is over $1,700 a year, right? Which, you know, may not sound like a huge amount to people who are living at kind of, you know, average incomes and above in Canada. But for someone living at low income, that is hugely dramatic. And this is certainly what we hear from our patients as well. And that is an average, right? Some people are getting a lot more than that. And our income security health promoters are seeing well over 400 distinct new patients per year coming through the program from our practice. So incredibly, incredibly busy. And I'm really excited to see what the actual evidence shows in terms of the health impacts of that as we get our RCT data over the next year or two. So that's been one approach. Another approach which came out for us around the same time was the development of, for us, of something called a medical legal partnership, where we actually partnered with Legal Aid Ontario that funded a full-time lawyer to work with our patients. You know, and this has been done in other settings. It's quite common in the US. It's less common in Canada, although we're certainly not the first. But we heard from our patients over and over again that legal pressures were affecting them from myriad different areas, right? Their housing, their family situations, their employment situations, their income situations. And, you know, our suspicions, again, have played out. Over the first 3 years of that program, one lawyer and one legal assistant have seen over 1,000 cases come through. And again, the evaluation is going on right now. It's actually being, the data is being crunched as we speak in terms of the actual impacts on that. But I can tell you from the preliminary pieces I've seen that it's been very positive. Another piece that we put in place was a literacy-focused program called Reach Out and Read, which involved giving free books and reading advice to children and, of course, parents of children under the age of 5. Sounds very simple, although this program has been shown through, I mean, again, it's very widespread in the U.S., and it's been shown to have a particularly strong impact in educational outcomes and literacy outcomes for those who live in the lowest income, lowest two income quintiles. And through our program, we have provided over 3,500 free books over the last 3 years of that running. So really excited to have that piece in place. And then the final piece of that initial wave is one that I think maybe sounds the least sexy, but I think is actually incredibly, incredibly powerful as a foundation for doing this work, is the routine collection of sociodemographic data, meaning we routinely ask our patients about their social determinants of health, their income, their housing situation, their immigration status, their sexual orientation, their disability, amongst other factors. And what this is starting to allow us to do is to actually, I mean, first of all, you know, use this information on the front lines of care, because frontline clinicians see the answers to these questions, but also start to look at it from the back end and start to say, you know, are there different outcomes for people living on social assistance, right, who have diabetes in our practice, or for people from certain ethnic groups? You know, and as we carry out interventions, we can actually track differential outcomes for groups that are impacted by different social determinants. And I think this will have a dramatic impact on the way we provide care to those groups and the types of interventions we design. So huge, huge, huge potential shift in the way we structure our care just because we're looking at what we're doing through a slightly different lens. Sorry, I'll let you break in there.
Yeah, no, I was going to say that, I mean, that's, it, yeah. It sounds like, you know, identifying the problem is one of the key issues, and it just opens up the door to allow all of these other sort of interventions to proceed.
Yeah.
So it's really, and it's very similar to many, many other health issues, is that you want to open up that door to a discussion. And once you get yes. there, you know, it makes it so much easier. And this is such an important one, given that it has such an impact on health.
Well, it's also that as you start to reorient your work and reorient your teams towards this, you start seeing whole new realms of potential intervention, right? Which is exactly what we've been exploring here. And we actually set up a committee on the social determinants of health that is very well attended. People get very excited about it. and is also pushing ahead with, you know, I think like the next phases of intervention, just based on the excitement amongst our providers around what we've seen so far. I mean, they're doing things like developing standardized tools for assessing programs' impact on health equity issues, for instance, using things like health equity impact assessments. We've developed, you know, frameworks for engaging in advocacy on social issues for our department and for members of our department. Frameworks for engaging community members to come in and provide their impact, input on our departmental planning of programs and services and evaluation and outcomes and direction, right? All of this is potentially will have a very radical impact on how we provide services and who we provide services to or who we direct our resources to. So really big stuff, I think, and I hope portends where the health system may be going in the future, right? As we sort of move more and more towards a population and community-based understanding of how to provide care, it's these types of interventions, especially, I mean, hopefully building up an evidence base around them, that I think may start to guide what future health teams look like.
Yeah. So, Mike, I'd be interested to hear what you have to say in regards to the you know, I mean, clearly, Gary, the passion and the interest and so on is, you need that to develop these very integrated processes. But Mike, for someone who is, maybe this is not their focus, how do you see all this stuff fitting into just your typical family practice setting?
Yeah, so I'm kind of in between where Gary is and as you say, this typical, because we have a practice, or my practice is a targeted practice. So they're designed to serve the needs of community members who are often perceived to be not as well taken care of. So that is things like recent immigrants, single moms, people with a drug use history, people, complex elderly, that kind of thing. So we have some of that, but I'm fortunate in that we have someone right in the same building as us with a moment's notice. Most of the time you can get in contact with as a social worker. So if there's a challenge that we identified, either accessing resources or where poverty is playing a key role for that patient, or is a part of that patient's life, we'll often hook them up with the social worker who is embedded in our clinic setting. And she can often address lots of things for that patient. And it's, you know, the social worker, we don't have the legal team, which is, we're a little ways from that, but they will help address things like getting, for immigrants, helping them fill out forms to get family members brought over, or for citizenship and those kind of things. And it can be incredibly helpful for people who are not just with poverty, et cetera, but struggling to navigate the system, if they can have someone to guide and assist them. Those pieces can be so large, but we're kind of looking at these things. Gary's team is kind of on the forefront, and that's why we're having him here. But many of us are at different stages kind of developing this process. Obviously, in certain communities, certain practices that are higher income practices, the need for legal services in that setting might be much reduced, and even a social worker might be somewhat reduced. But so it would have to be tailored somewhat to communities. But here in Alberta, and I think maybe the LHINs might do some of this too, Gary, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but some of the primary care networks actually will combine their services for individual clinics that can't afford them or make those available even within their clinic space, where a short distance away, there's a whole team ready to help that patient navigate the system and seek out additional funding.
Yeah, and I think that's absolutely right. I think there are many, many ways to do this. And again, I think I've alluded to some of that before, but like, you know, in the US, this is done by volunteers in many health settings. In the UK, this is done by NGOs that kind of partner with health agencies. I mean, there's also, though, a long history in Canada of health teams doing this kind of work, like community health centers, certainly in Ontario, which have had a mandate to do this for a very long time. But I guess, you know, my advice for any health team is just to start, right? To first of all, identify a need, and it may not be every need of our patients, but identify a need that seems to be popping up and start to think about, can we reorient resources that we have towards doing this kind of work? Like, can we direct, you know, a social worker or a nurse with an interest in this, or someone else, or a dietitian in some cases, or a pharmacist, towards spending some of their time developing these interventions for the need that's being identified, and then start to kind of build it out from there, right? Start to approach funders and say, for instance, our income security health promoters are funded by the Ministry of Health of Ontario. You know, I was surprised as anyone when they agreed to fund those positions, but they didn't even really bat an eyelash as far as I could tell. They got that there was a need there and they fund it. So sometimes it's just about making the ask and these things come in.
James, we can all probably play a role. You've written some books yourself, haven't you?
About poverty?
No. The books that you've written on pharmaceutical sciences and things like that. Don't you have a couple published textbooks?
Yes. I'm not sure.
You can give those to Gary for to hand out.
Oh, yes. Yes, for just some light reading.
That's right. I would love that. It'll be immediate light reading pile.
Yeah.
And I'm sure your patients would love it, too.
Oh, yeah. And it's an absolute...
Here's some books to improve reading.
And it's an absolute cure for insomnia.
So, you know, I wanted to say, I think there's another level to talk about this at, right? And I imagine that many people sort of hear this conversation. They say, you know what? You're just kind of brushing on the surface of this thing, right? You're kind of dealing with the tip of an iceberg here. And I think that is true in the sense that, you know, how much of poverty or homelessness or social isolation can we really deal with patient by patient? And I think it is worth mentioning that there are bigger level approaches to think that we can engage in and we can take here, and truly approaches that are targeted at shifting social structures and shifting social policy towards reducing the health impacts of some of these issues. And you know, if you're okay with that, I think it's worth kind of having a bit of a conversation around where we fit into that as health providers.
Oh,
as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, just take us down that path.
Yeah, because, I mean, in many ways, you know, and I think we've seen this with other health issues. You know, I think smoking is a really good example of an issue that clinicians started to really identify on the front lines of health. You know, not everyone thought it was an important issue to deal with, although certain really passionate people pushed it forward, became more and more accepted in the health world, and then saw the impact of that health, of the health voice around that, filter into the public policy world. You know, to the point where governments started legislating laws and social policy changes that really have had a far bigger impact on smoking rates, I think, than the individual frontline counseling that we spend a lot of our time doing. And I would make the argument that we should be thinking in very similar ways about the kinds of social issues we've been talking about here, and the kinds of impact that we can have as providers on the social policy environment around these. You know, once we accept that there is a very clear evidentiary link between someone's social situation and their health, we can then start bringing that. I mean, we should be doing the frontline practice stuff because that's what we are really good at doing, but start bringing that perspective out of that frontline practice and up to policymakers to really start implementing real change. And I've seen this play out in very real ways and very significant ways over the time I've been in practice, you know, through things like advocacy on changing labor laws, which sounds like a really funny thing for health providers to be involved in. But there was a really big movement over the last 3 years in Ontario around this amongst health providers in partnership with advocates for people living in precarious work situations. And there was a huge legislative change that happened because of that advocacy, right? And the health piece of that was very clearly evident in the social policy changes that came about, you know, in very obvious ways, like not requiring sick notes anymore for workers who miss a day or two of work from a cold. But then into sort of more detailed and even higher impact changes there. And I see it in the income security world. I mean, I was asked to be part of a commission that developed a 10-year roadmap to income security reform for the province of Ontario. And we, you know, I sat for a year and a half on this thing. We developed a great report, 98 recommendations. Everyone should read it. It is maybe as exciting as James's textbooks for nighttime reading. But what we saw a couple of weeks ago, actually, in the provincial budget in Ontario was a lot of the recommendations from that roadmap being put into action in a very real way, and probably the first major steps towards big income security reform that we've seen in Ontario for 20 or 25 years, right? And again, I think that having a health voice in that process had a very significant impact on what those changes look like. And my prediction is that if this is truly carried out over the next number of years, that it'll have a huge impact on health for those living at the kind of most impacted ends of the social spectrum in Ontario. So really exciting stuff. And, you know, again, like my training to do this is nothing really beyond my medical school training. But there is enough there to bring in the kind of health and poverty and health and social determinants evidence into these types of circles that it really does shift conversations and shift policymakers towards really taking action on these issues. So pretty exciting stuff.
Yeah. No, and I would agree. I think, you know, and it, especially if you have passionate people who are driving it, because like you said, your training is, you know, you just care about it and you've looked into it and got kind of like what Mike and I have done from an evidence perspective. Neither he or I were really trained all that much, and maybe it's quite obvious, but it's but you know, a lot of this is what you're passionate about, and I totally agree that, you know, it's the infrastructure changes that will make a big, you know, a big impact. You know you can solve individual people's issues or help solve them, but you really need a change in the entire framework to deal with this as a community or as a in a government setting.
Absolutely. And I mean, the fact that advocacy is now one of the key pillars of core competencies, mm-hmm. you know, in the family medicine world and for the Royal College, speaks to the fact that I think that the medical world accepts that we need to be doing this work. Again, you know, the question is always, well, how do we fit this into our day-to-day lives? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think you point to the fact that it starts with passion. It starts with finding an issue that you really care about and you think matters to your patients, and then kind of builds out from there, right? And I don't think it takes a lot more than just feeling in your gut like something needs to be done, starting with a letter, starting with a meeting with a politician somewhere, and mm-hmm. then seeing where it goes.
Yeah, no,
you know, sure. We have such powerful voices when it comes to this type of advocacy. Yeah. And I see that again over and over and over again. It's quite amazing.
So on that level, those are some of the sort of things that you could do on a bigger scale. Are there any other sort of educational things or any other issues that you'd like to talk about in regards to this?
Well, sure. I mean, you know, I think the education piece really speaks to, again, to the kind of culture shift that's happening in the medical world around this. So, again, this is building off conversations that have been happening for decades, but a recognition by medical educators that we have to be training our students and our residents in the skills to deal with social issues on a number of levels. So we have developed, for instance, core curriculum at the University of Toronto for the undergraduate medical program. I mean, they now have, as every school does, a whole sort of stream on social determinants of health teaching. But we get 6 hours to teach them how to specifically address poverty as a core health issue. And we teach those types of interventions at every level, again, from the poverty tool all the way up to thinking about higher level social advocacy on this. And that is accepted as a core part of the program. And we've started to see this type of training being picked up by other medical schools as well. And certainly I'd say the broader medical academy is very, very interested in this as well, starting with those core competencies and then seeing it filter down to what that looks like from a curriculum perspective. And again, I mentioned this at the end of the last podcast, but we do a lot of continuing medical education around this as well. We have, you know, a main pro accredited workshop on, again, specifically treating poverty, which of course goes beyond poverty. Poverty is just, you know, a harbinger of all other social ills in our society. But very, very well attended sessions there and really interesting discussion, right? And I see the kinds of progression or sort of shifts in thinking that people go through as they engage with these issues in a really intense way, you know, and first of all, challenge them and saying, you know, there's no way I can do this. But as we explore it deeper and deeper, saying, well, we have to do this and let's start to think about how we can incorporate this into frontline practice. So really important to see that playing out in a very real way in the education world. And again, I mean, I come back over and over to this idea of a culture shift within the medical world and a shift towards truly accepting that interventions on social issues have to be a core part of medical training and medical practice at every level. And I think we're moving towards that, right? Maybe slowly, sometimes incrementally, but in a very, very real way.
And I know some of the sort of the naysayers, if you will say that there are issues around, you know, is this even the role of what we should be doing? Isn't this someone else's problem? But I think you'd probably disagree with that quite strongly.
Yeah, I think I would actually.
Yeah.
I mean, again, you know, we are pushed number one by the evidence, which is, I honestly think it's irrefutable in terms of the evidence that looks at that link between health and social issues. And I think we're also, once we open our ears to what our patients tell us they need, we're truly pushed by that as well. And those messages, I think, are coming through loud and clear. So I think it's up to the medical world to kind of keep up with conversations in society around this and accept that we are going to have to deal with these social foundations of health if we truly want to keep pushing forward on improving Canadians' health, and especially the health of those who are most disadvantaged. Who are those who become sickest the fastest?
Yeah. So it sounds like, I mean, it's such a key thing to, you know, on an individual level, identify this initially and then start to put in place processes that can work within your own practice, but even on a much bigger level of, you know, trying to influence policymakers and so on, and really just bringing it to the forefront of the minds of people, because it's such an important issue, and it really is very similar to every other important issue that we need to deal with it. And I just love the passion and that you bring to this, and also, you know, a lot of your ideas and suggestions, we'll put links to a lot of the great work that you're doing so that people can go look at what you're doing, but we'll also put links to other sort of aspects of what other people are doing internationally and so on. So is there anything else you'd like to add, Gary, about this whole issue?
I think this is a conversation that it's not in its infancy, but it's maybe in its teenage years. I think mm-hmm. it is very much evolving. I think it is a really, really exciting conversation to be a part of. And I think there is a truly strong and growing group of physicians and other health providers who are working on this in very real ways and truly across the country, actually. And we have networks that reach into every province, and we have support from, you know, literally medical organizations in every single province and territory across the country around this. Mm-hmm. So I want to make it very clear that I am not in any way an isolated voice on this. I'm speaking for a very strong community of providers that is carrying this conversation forward. Always happy to speak to people who are interested in this area.
Oh, very cool. Mike, any amazing last words that you'd like to add?
They will never be amazing, James, but thank you for setting the bar ever so high for me.
Yes.
All I will say is that I'm really glad Gary could come on the show. Gary's someone who started out working in practice with nothing more than kind of a passion to improve care for the patients in his community, and sometimes in a way that we often don't think about their social needs, and kind of grew that organically himself into something very large that the whole country is using now, and should be using, should be thinking about, and also with an moving even to an international presence. So kind of went, you know, from his local community to his practice to his the practice community, all the way up to the province and then the country, and just really growing out a passion, which is an amazing thing. So congratulations to you, Gary.
And also, you know, keeping evidence at the forefront of it, you know, to say, you know, what works, how do we look at it, what can we do, and all that sort of stuff. Realizing that this is a very different evidence base, but I'm excited to hear that you are trying to do things like RCTs and so on, which is great because it really will help put into context the impact that these sorts of things have. So, no, very, very cool. And thanks so much for, you know, coming on the podcast with us. I think it was really useful.
It's a pleasure. And actually, you know, I hope that in a year or two, you can invite one of my research colleagues on and you can talk in much more detail about that evidence base, because it should just be pouring out over the next couple of years.
Yeah, no, very cool. And at any time, you know, let us know. We'll put more information on our site and so on, because it is, like I said in the previous podcast, it's a tad more important than a prescription for, I'm not going to go after diltiazem. I'll go after verapamil this time.
You really have a hate on for that class of calcium channel blockers.
But yeah, no, so Garrett, that was really great stuff. So I think we'll just leave it at that. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.
Thank you so much.